Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. The problems of old age was last week's roundtable topic. If you missed this valuable discussion, you will want to send 10 cents to the roundtable for your copy of the pamphlet on aging successfully. Now for today's University of Chicago Roundtable, we present Edward H. Levy of the Law School of the University of Chicago. Mr. Levy.
One of the great problems facing the country is the problem of monopoly. In the new session of Congress, legislation against monopoly is expected. The President has asked Congress to close the loopholes in the anti-monopoly laws. He has also told the Congress it may be necessary for the government, as a last resort, to go into the business of building steel plants. Participating in today's discussion on monopoly are one of the leading figures in the Congress, Senator Joseph C. Omani, Democrat of Wyoming, former chairman of the Temporary National Economic Committee, and a lifelong student of monopoly. His views may well become laws. And Melvin DeShazzo, economist of the School of Business and Public Administration of Cornell University, well-known authority on the steel industry. Possibly the first question we should try to answer in this discussion on monopoly is whether monopoly is increasing in this country. DeShazzo, is monopoly increasing?
There's no clear evidence that the monopoly problem is getting worse. We all know that the country is bigger, and so businesses are bigger. But this does not mean that monopoly operations are bigger or worse. For example, the Standard Oil Company controlled 90% of the refinery capacity in 1879, and Standard Oil and no oil company has a monopoly position as strong now as Standard Oil had 70 years ago. Steel companies show the same kind of decline in the relative dominance of the largest firm in the industry, the U.S. Steel Corporation. The listener should realize that I do not deny a large and continuing concentration of power, but the statistical picture of increase in that power is blurred. But it does not show that monopoly is now worse. Today there's much more competition than people realize.
How about it, Senator? Is monopoly getting more and more?
Well, it's the concentration of power, which DeShazzo admits, which is the very heart of the problem. I can cite statistics side by side with his. Take the case of the oil industry. The Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Standard Oil of New York, now known as Saucony Vacuum, the Standard of California with the Texas Company are united in the oil operations in the Near East. There, they control far more petroleum than was controlled by the Standard Oil of New Jersey when the Supreme Court of the United States dissolved it in an antitrust suit. Now, on another field, there are 125 basic commodities needed by the people of the United States, from steel and aluminum to cigarettes and electric refrigerators. Of these, 75% of the total production in each case is controlled by four or fewer companies. That's an evidence of concentration of power. But the most striking evidence that I've seen recently was that which was published in Dr. Kaplan's book for the Committee on Economic Development. A table showing that less than 0.1% of all of the employers in the United States employ about 56% of all the industrial workers. That's the sort of concentration that makes a proletariat. And a proletariat makes for totalitarian government. That's the vice of monopoly which we must avoid.
President Truman has said it may be necessary for the federal government to go into the steel business and increase steel production capacity to destroy the steel shortage bottleneck in our economy. DeShazzo, should the government go into the steel business?
I'm against the government going into the steel business and competing against private owners. In addition, there is both a short-run and a long-run aspect that is worth looking at in this particular question. In the short run, substantial new steel capacity would have an important and undesirable inflationary impact because of the very large amount of steel that is required in order to produce that capacity. It would appear better in the short run, to rely on technical expansion such as the use of oxygen in blast furnaces and steel furnaces, as well as additions to existing plants. In the long run, for government, the greatest monopolist of all, to enter into competition with the steel industry is not my idea of a good anti-monopoly measure. If we're to have private enterprise, we must have a basis for confidence in business investment.
Well, but to do that, we must provide the rule by which you can have competition in private industry. I think it ought to be made clear to our audience that the president did not recommend that the government go into the steel industry as the first step. He recommended first that there should be a study of the production of commodities in short supply. Secondly, that the government should consider making loans in order to produce competitive production. And only finally did he suggest that the government should go into the business. Our great trouble, de Chazot, it seems to me, and this is admitted upon every hand in the financial districts of New York, private money is not coming into business. Everybody in New York, in Wall Street in New York, is complaining about the lack of risk capital. And that's because of this concentration of economic power upon which you and I agreed at the outset. So we've got to find the way to stop this concentration.
I think the president's recommendation really recognizes two important things. The first is that the steel industry is sufficiently concentrated so that a very few persons will determine whether or not there should be an increase in capacity in that industry. And of course, that decision may affect the fate of the nation. And the second thing that I think he was recognizing was that what has happened in this country is that not only do we have great concentration among business, but as an important part of our economy, we have government assistance to the big and to the little.
Yes, and Ed, the great danger of that is that it will produce a depression. Take the steel industry, for example. If a few heads of a very few companies, six companies at the outset, can determine by their own private judgment how much steel the people of the United States are going to have, then the people of the United States, who need this steel, need more than they are getting, will turn to government. But the danger, de Chazot, is that before they turn to government to do that, because we're not getting enough steel, shortages in business will develop, and that in turn will bring about unemployment, and that in turn will bring about the decrease of purchasing power, and that in turn will bring the depression.
May I say, Senator, with respect to that, that there is a very real question in my mind as to how much more steel we need in order to prevent this depression. That is, the current shortages have in fact extended the capital outlay programs of industry as a whole in such a way as to prevent what would otherwise have been a much more rapid inflationary boom. Furthermore, I would like to add that in the Marshall Plan itself, we are increasing steel production abroad. The increase in steel production as it increases abroad will reduce the impact of demand for steel in this country.
Well, de Chazot, I wish you'd come out to Wyoming sometime and out to these great western states. I'd show you marvelous opportunities for the use of steel. We haven't begun to develop this country as it can be developed. We haven't begun to build the power plants that ought to be built. We haven't begun to irrigate and reclaim our arid land as far as we can. There are needs for steel in the development of petroleum, in the development of our oil shale and our coal deposits. And if the steel industry won't give us that steel, why, the people are going to demand big government. So I say, industrial leadership has got to determine of its own mind whether it's going to yield to the demand of the people for greater productivity or whether it's going to have the people turn to government. I want industry to do it.
The president also discusses in his message to Congress the need for better housing, and he says that the great bottleneck is the bottleneck of cost.
I suppose that we'd agree that that, again, is a reference to the problem of concentration and the problem of enormous restrictions, labor, capital, all the way up and down the line, that you can't have an economy which is restrictive and inefficient and then get the housing that you would get otherwise.
Oh, there were the TNEC investigation, Ed Levy, to which you referred, demonstrated that there are restrictions in the local building codes. There have been dealers, wholesale dealers in building commodities, and the labor unions too, which in the belief that there wasn't work enough to go around, was trying to spread out the work. My point is that everything we see around us proves that a fully employed economy will use more goods and more services than have ever before been used in the United States.
Well, gentlemen, we're against monopoly, and so is everybody else, so far as I can see. The question is, have we been doing the right things about it in this country? What about the antitrust approach, DeShazo? Has that resulted in breaking up monopolies?
Well, the main approach, antitrust approach, as I understand it, is one of attempting to destroy cases of collusion and agreement. That is, it is punitive and has involved the breaking up of large companies only as an incident to that elimination of collusion. There have been a few instances where corporations have been broken up, but relatively few.
Well, the antitrust approach is sound so far as it goes. Any prosecution of price fixing, of production restraints and control of the division of territories is in the public interest. That ought to go on. But it must be remembered that the punitive method is not always effective immediately. Ed Levy, you will remember that it took more than 20 years for a certain decree against the meat packers to become effective. The defendant in a antitrust case can carry the issue to the highest court in the land, and with the best lawyers available can almost laugh at the antitrust division. What we need is not a punitive approach, but a preventive approach. I have been advocating primarily that we take away from the great corporations the corporate power to do the acts which are the cause of monopolistic growth.
It does seem to me that the antitrust approach has kept alive in this country the symbol of free competition.
We have that symbol. Even the monopolists call themselves advocates of free competition.
I don't know, Senator, whether I am disagreeing with you on this point or not, but I do not believe that we can legislate price competition in this country. The form that competition will take is governed by the market structure in which businesses operate. If you know, for example, that competition will meet your competitors, will meet your price reduction, and if you know that industry sales revenue will not increase at the lower price, then you know in advance that you will be worse off if you lower your price.
Well,
in
but,
this situation, you will compete for more business on other bases, that is, engineering, new products, quality improvements, which is an area in which we've had continued competition.
But, DeShazo, let me call attention to the fact that I didn't say that I want legislation to enforce price competition. I want our antitrust laws to continue to prohibit price fixing. Now, there's a very great difference between the two. If you and Levy get together in a corner of the room and by a few gestures agree upon the price at which you're going to sell me that pencil, that's a violation of law. But if by just ordinary developments it happens that you offer me each a pencil at the same price, there's no price competition, but there's been no violation of law.
Well, I'm not so sure I'd agree with that, Senator. It seems to me that the antitrust laws aren't supposed to legislate price competition. What they're supposed to do is to keep the units sufficiently small and not engaging in collusive arrangements. I think that if we have only three people in an industry, it doesn't make any difference whether they agree or not. And I think the Supreme Court is coming around to that point of view. They will act as though they have agreed. And I think you would have to agree with me, at least in this, wouldn't you, DeShazo, that by and large, in our big industries, the companies are much bigger than they have to be in order to get the efficiencies of large-scale operation.
On that, I would certainly agree, although you are aware that economists have not had available to them the detailed cost figures which would enable them to set any limit to the so-called economies of scale, or the size at which a plant ceases to increase in efficiency with the increase in its size. The big problem here is where those economies of scale become the advantages of size in bargaining, in buying technical know-how, in preempting resources, and thereby exert a pressure on industry and on the price level, which is not justified by cost of production.
I think we should make the point that the antitrust approach is really a non-regulatory approach. That is, the government is not going to tell the companies what they have to do. I think that's a point that a lot of people forget, including the government. I noticed that a recent decree entered by the Antitrust Division actually provides that when the Bureau of Labor Statistics go down, the companies are going to have to issue new price lists. And it seems to me that's flirting with price fixing and price regulation. And you would agree, Senator, wouldn't you, that that is really contrary to the idea of antitrust enforcement?
Oh, yes. The antitrust theory, as I see it, has always been merely to prevent these collusive abuses. The antitrust procedure cannot compel an individual or a group of individuals to engage in a certain business, but it is designed to keep the door of opportunity open for those who wish to come in. The unfortunate part about monopoly is that sometimes by direct conspiracy and sometimes just by weight of economic power, it prevents new capital from coming in and new enterprisers from developing a part of the industry.
Now, the antitrust approach is only one of the weapons used by the government against monopoly. I'm not sure it's the most significant. There are other ways of approaching the problem. I suppose one is by way of regulation, and that we have adopted in a widespread way, regulation with exemptions from the antitrust laws. I noticed that the Civil Aeronautics Board is now revising or interpreting its regulations so that it may put out of business the non-scheduled airlines. It seems to me that we ought to call attention to the fact that these regulatory agencies do frequently limit competition.
Well, that's an illustration of what we commonly call government by men instead of government by law. It's inevitable that vested interests in any industry will attempt to take over control of the government agency which is supposed to regulate them. That effort was being made during the last year with respect to the Federal Power Commission, with respect to the Federal Trade Commission. And I'm well aware of what you say, Ed, that in the aviation, an effort has been made to prevent new competition from coming in. That is because those who are already in the business seem somehow inherently want to keep any new competitor out of the business. They want to divide it up and keep it for themselves. That's the inherent vice of monopoly.
I would like to get back, Senator, if I could, to a point that I left in a somewhat confusing state. I would not disagree with you at all that the excessive abuse of monopoly power is undesirable and should be eliminated. I wondered, however, that in trying to set a standard for pricing policies in particular, whether you would take a position similar to that has been assumed to be justified in the cement case, namely that price discrimination or variations in the mill net price received in sales to different customers is contrary to law.
Well, I think when you come to a discussion of the cement case, you venture in a technical field that's very difficult to settle in a half-hour discussion upon the radio. It's a very complicated system. The trouble in the cement case was that there were identical prices charged by all of the companies, and the Supreme Court found, as a matter of fact, that the basing point system was there used for the purpose of fixing the price, and therefore that it was a violation of law.
I agree, Senator, that DeShazo's fears about the cement case are much greater than they need be, but he is calling attention to the fact that we have things, we have acts which do prevent price discrimination, in a sense prevent sales at low prices. They are comparable to state acts which prevent unfair practice acts. I wonder how those fit in with an anti-monopoly program.
Well, before I answer you on that, Ed, I should like to say that in my judgment, and I reached this conclusion a long time ago, the most effective way to prevent monopolistic practices by these huge organizations which dominate our economy is to make the individual officers personally responsible for the initiative which they take in violating the law. If the officers of a company themselves order a policy which is against the law, then those officers themselves ought to be personally responsible instead of making the corporation liable only for a little fine which the corporation can pay so easily.
And in addition, I would say to DeShazo on his fears about the Robinson-Patman Act and price discrimination, that what he's pointing to is that we have failed to solve the problem of monopoly. If we had, we wouldn't need those acts.
I would like to interject here that I am much more concerned with a more basic issue, that is, whether price discrimination itself is not in the public interest. I merely call your attention to the fact that with nationally advertised prices, postage stamp prices, zone prices, that a very large percentage of delivered prices characterize our economy, in which variations in the mill net are common. I would like to make just one other point.
Well,
that
I'd like
government
to answer.
Itself, through TVA and in the regulation of public utility rates, recognizes the fact it sets and approves discriminatory prices.
Well, my answer to that is a very simple one. I think that when you have a monopolized industry, and then you say they should act in the public interest, and then you compare their actions to the actions of the government, you're saying no more than what Senator Omani began this discussion with. They are the government. And it seems to me that represents a very serious problem.
And let me add that I'm not so much concerned about pricing itself as I am concerned in the development of collectivism. Our trouble is that we now have economic collectivism in the great units which dominate our economy. Take the steel business, DeShazo, in which you are a recognized expert. United States Steel Corporation is managed by employees for the benefit of stockholders who themselves exercise no power whatsoever. The United States Steel is a collectivist enterprise, just as the American Telephone and Telegraph Company is. A defendant in a suit started just a day or so ago by the Department of Justice. We have economic collectivism, and the great danger is that we'll have political collectivism as a result. That's
Senator,
the vice of
Senator,
monopoly.
May I point out that even though you didn't have this monopoly that you're speaking of, even though you didn't have the great concentration in the U.S. Steel Corporation, is it conceivable that individual plants in the steel industry could be so small that they could sell at a purely competitive price, say, on a uniform mill net?
Well, possibly we don't have to come to that question until we get the companies down to the size that you say we can have them at in the steel industry. But I think, gentlemen, we ought to get down to earth a little bit and discuss what we ought to do about monopoly. What kind of a legislative program...
Now, may I interrupt at that point to say first that I don't necessarily believe that we ought to cut business down. I think that the demand which a fully employed people will exert will need much more production than we are getting now. Therefore, I say the remedy for monopoly is through a federal charter law to define the powers, the duties, and the responsibilities of the organized economy. We must recognize that we've moved from an individual economy into an organized economy, and we have not laid down the rule of operation for the organization.
What about the bill that you proposed, Senator Omani, to close the loopholes, that is to prevent mergers under the Clayton Act, Section 7 of the Clayton Act, to prevent the acquisition of assets? What about that?
You're referring to the so-called Omani-Kefauver bill. The Clayton Act, passed during the Wilson administration, prohibited monopolistic mergers resulting from the purchase of stock. The loophole was that the promoters of the mergers purchased the assets. We desire to include assets in the prohibition. That's the first step, to prevent monopoly. But the most important thing, in my judgment, is to define the powers and the responsibilities of the organization.
Would you suggest, Senator, that it would be a good thing if some kind of a conference could be called to determine the limits as to size or percentage of control so that we could have some standards in legislation?
As long as 10 years ago, I recommended that there should be such a conference to determine what a modern corporation law should contain.
I would like to make a suggestion there that it is very difficult, of course, to determine the size of a given company in terms of percentage of the total market. It may be desirable to limit individual plants and companies to given areas.
Gentlemen, I think that we've shown that we're against monopoly. Everybody's against monopoly. I also think we have shown that some steps must be taken, possibly this idea of a conference, to get more concrete on the subject so that some kind of legislative proposal as to standards can be adopted.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss What Should We Do About Monopoly? With Senator Joseph C. Omani, Democrat of Wyoming, Melvin D. Chazot, economist of the School of Business and Public Administration of Cornell University, and Edward H. Levy of the Law School of the University of Chicago as participants. And now, a special announcement.
The University of Chicago and NBC announce an exciting adventure in education. University of Chicago Roundtable Home Study Courses on World Politics and Economics in the Modern World. These Roundtable Home Study Courses present a new adventure in ideas to aid you in understanding the challenge of our times. They combine the facilities of the Roundtable program and its expert participants, the NBC network and its independent affiliated stations, the distinguished economists and political scientists of the University of Chicago faculty, and the university's home study division. If you want to understand basic economic principles in order to make better judgments on national economic policy, if you want better to understand the conflicting proposals made about international politics, you will be interested in registering for Roundtable Home Study courses and receiving the specially designed library of books and pamphlets on world politics and economics in the modern world. These courses are for adults and are open to all. Write to your local station or the University of Chicago Roundtable and ask for the leaflet describing the courses and explaining how you can participate in Roundtable Home Study.
Be sure to write for your copy of today's discussion and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. The address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the roundtable will discuss, should we adopt federal health insurance? Today's roundtable originated in Washington, D.C. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.